Lemon, there was once a great American named George Henderson. He met a woodland ape or Sasquatch, and despite its dangerous message of environmentalism, became his friend. But when the time came to do the hard thing and send it back into the forest where it belonged, and birds could perch on its shoulder because it was gentle, George Henderson summoned the strength, and by God, he did it.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Two eyes, two ears, a chin, a mouth, 10 fingers, two nipples, a butt, two kneecaps, a penis. I have just described to you the Loch Ness Monster. And the reward for his capture? All the riches in Scotland. So I have one question. Why are you here?
Now, we've sort of talked about the quest for Bigfoot and the search for Bigfoot, and I know you had the book with Mark Hall that came out recently, True Giants.
What we found is that there's a whole history and study of Bigfoot, a creature that's about adult size, 6.5 to 8 feet tall. And that's a paranthropus-type creature from Africa, Asia, that migrated across the Bering Strait, down through the Rockies and the Western Mountains, down through the Andes in South America. Very consistent reports of the Bigfoot Sasquatch, or as Ivan Sanderson called it, the Omaw. Now, what Mark Hall and I started picking up is that within the files of Bigfoot researchers, including John Green, Roger Patterson, and some of these other guys from the 50s and 60s, they started noticing that there were reports of creatures in addition to Bigfoot.
Okay, yeah.
That they were between 20 feet tall and 12 feet tall. And that, for instance, Roger Patterson in his book, he called this the big hairy ape. There was a creature that was bigger than Bigfoot, but it was almost like the information about this, while they took it seriously, it was way beyond something they wanted to study. And same thing for John Green. He did the Pit Lake reports of this creature that was almost 15 feet tall, where the people that were making a dam actually compared the height of the creature based upon the trees that they stood next to. And they were looking at a giant, a true giant, as Mark and I call.
Okay.
So what we did is we took the history of these true giants from all around the world. We found that what we think is going on is that Gigantopithecus, which people like Grover Krantz have sort of tried to force the Gigantopithecus fossils, make them responsible for the Bigfoot reports, that it doesn't work that way. Gigantopithecus was an ape-like creature in Asia that lived for 3 million years, and they were 10 feet tall. That they are the true giants, that they really are bigger than the Bigfoot reports, that they're very tall in stature, and actually may have a huge head with a sagittal crest and all of that, but they may have very long and thin limbs.
Okay, so it's sort of like that we're dealing with two different creatures here.
Yes,
we're dealing with
two
the Bigfoot
different.
And the true giants.
Right, and one of the reasons with my friend Patrick Weege, I wrote the book The Field Guide to Bigfoot in 1999, was that there's scientists like Jeff Meldrum, Grover Krantz, because they're, even though they act like that they're radical Bigfoot researchers, they really are academics, and they have told me, and they've been angry with me, because they said the only way that we're going to make science pay attention to us is for all of us to do a united front, that there's only one kind of Bigfoot, Yeti, Yeren, creature around the world, and we have to prove that one, and that you're really messing it up, Lauren, by saying there's these different kinds. I mean, I think there's a skunk ape in Florida that's different than Bigfoot in the Pacific Northwest. I think the true giants that actually may still exist in Asia are totally different than Bigfoot. I think there's a little hobbit-like creatures in the South Sea Islands that in Hawaii they're called Minihu, and in Flores Island they're called the Igogo. So I think there's different kinds of hairy hominid and anthropoids all around the world, and that we do a disservice to the native peoples who are telling us about these by calling them all Bigfoot, or even, you know, calling them all snowmen, like they did up in Siberia with this recent conference, where everything's a snowman, everything's a Yeti, everything's a Bigfoot, as if you can use those names interchangeably. I don't think that's true at all.
Right, right. It's almost like, you know, a pit bull is different from a poodle, but they're both dogs. It's like
right.
People are making this mistake by sort of using Bigfoot and trying to just force it onto all the different
right.
creatures.
Or I think it's even more to the motto of it's the difference between a domestic cat, a tiger, and a lion.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really different species and genus. They're really very different animals we're talking about between Bigfoot, Yeti, and a Yeren or the hobbits in the South Sea Islands.
All right, yeah, because that's sort of, I alluded to the Gian Cassar book earlier, he sort of has a similar idea where he's saying, you know, multiple bipedal apes around the planet, different types of creatures. So you're sort of in, I wouldn't say agreement, but along the lines of that idea too. So that's cool.
Right.
Now, it seems like also, and, you know, maybe you can speak to this, I'm sure, but I've noticed, and maybe I guess it is true because you talked about the contactee issue earlier, but it seems like there's more the paranormal element is creeping back into Bigfoot ness, if you will, and people are sort of going back to the paranormal idea, maybe because they're looking for answers still, and then they think, well, we've exhausted the actual animal idea, so now we have to take a second look at the paranormal aspect. I mean, what are your? I know you've had thoughts on the paranormal element for years, but what's your take, you know, here in 2011 on that?
Well, I think one of the fortunate or unfortunate things about having a 50-year overview of the field is that it does go in cycles. During the 1970s, we had a time of high strangeness. People forget it, but there were individuals, there were paperback books, there were presentations where people were seriously saying that Bigfoot was stepping out of UFOs, was surrounding themselves with electromagnetic fields, was doing telepathy with, human beings. Then it kind of disappeared in the 80s and 90s and the first part of the 21st century. And unfortunately now, I mean, Bigfoot and Yeti and all of these things are so popular that we're actually having an explosion of a lot more people trying to think about it. So you do have the person that comes along and says, well, we've got to think about the fourth dimension. I had a doctor come in here the other day, and he very seriously, very down-to-earth kind of guy said, well, I think that, not enough people are exploring that these Bigfoot creatures are coming from the fourth dimension. And he just was saying with a straight face, and his brother was here who happened to be a lawyer, and he was rolling his eyes the whole time. So, it's just it's another consideration for people. Now myself, I very much agree with my mentor, Ivan Sanderson, that I have an extremely hard time explaining one unknown with another unknown.
Okay, yeah.
And I think that's the Freudian point of view. Charles Ford, actually, I came across a quote this morning from him, and it said, I will not insult you by, he said something like, I've heard talk of the fourth dimension, but I will not insult you with writing about that. So I think that we have to be very careful because it's so far out there as an explanation with absolutely no proof. It's a great fantasy and it's a great concept to intellectually play with, but it doesn't really help us on a biological, zoological basis for trying to explore the fact that Bigfoot are leaving footprints, they're pooping in the woods, they're tearing down branches, they're leaving hair samples. This is all biologically based. They're eating, you know, berries and grasshoppers and little pica. What do we do about that? That doesn't, you know, they don't zoom over from the fourth dimension to do that, do they? Or do they? Or, are they coming out of UFOs and planting themselves here and then going back into the UFO and conversing with Elvis? I mean, you know, we have to at some point stop and say, we do want to look at this scientifically, and we need to look at the as Ivan Sanderson called it, he wants to look at the tangible intangibles.
Yeah. Well, it would be kind of depressing if Bigfoot just came to our dimension just to go to the bathroom.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Or to occasionally sit down in front of a TV and watch a baseball game.
Now, we've talked here about, to really butcher sort of a pun here, the big daddy of cryptozoology, that's the Bigfoot. And we talked about this in our original conversation back in 2006, how I have sort of a latent fear in a way that if we capture the Bigfoot, that it'll eventually hurt cryptozoology. I'm sort of coming over that now, and I'm feeling like, given the popularity of the creature, it actually would be this sort of rising tide lifts all ships situation where cryptozoology would be boosted into out of the paranormal, I think, completely, if we find the Bigfoot. So, but there's all these other creatures that sort of lurk beneath.
Let me address something you've said first. I think that too often we in cryptozoology respond to the critics, the skeptics, the scoffers, the debunkers, without realizing we have our own foundation to support. We really can't always react in a defensive posture to such claims that we're a pseudoscience or we're part of the paranormal. Well, I think we have to really keep going down this road that we're a subdiscipline of zoology, that we have a cryptozoological method, which very simply stated is to listen to the testimony of local and native and indigenous peoples, use that as a starting point, and then discover animals based upon finding physical evidence. Now, is misidentification part of what's going on? Of course. 80% of all Bigfoot reports are a woman in a fur coat, back end of a moose, a bear. They're misidentifications. 1% are hoaxes. But the media, the debunkers, the skeptics try to tell us that we're dealing with 95% of hoaxes. It's just not true. Which leaves us with 19% of all the cases we're looking at that are the unknowns. And we need to keep pursuing that. Now, what you're talking about with Bigfoot, with Yeti, with the Loch Ness Monster, those three are what I call the celebrity cryptids.
Yeah.
The celebrity cryptids, and in the 19th century, the other celebrity cryptid was the great sea serpent. So those four groups of cryptids are the one that most people talk about, with the exception we now have, as I was quoted in 1999 by ABC News, chupacabras are like Jennifer Lopez. They're both cross-cultural. we have a real resurgence of interest in the chupacabras now and again, but mostly it's Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, and Yeti. And what I'm really surprised about is how popular Yeti, the abominable snowman, is becoming. I think we're going to have some remarkable new expeditions and movies on that, but that's a whole another side thing. But anyway, what you're asking is, really, are there other cryptids around the world? And that's one of the main thrusts of this whole museum that I've got going, is I bring people in here, I talk about the celebrity cryptids, but I say, at any one time around the world, there's 200 other active pursuits of other cryptids that may turn out to be brand new species. For instance, in 2010, the largest new animal that was discovered was a giant monitor lizard from Luzon, Philippines, that scientists did not even start looking for until 2003. The local people knew about it, but nobody would pay attention to them. And how big does this monitor lizard turn out to be? 6.5 feet long.
Oh, wow.
Climbs trees and eats fruits. It's only one of three lizards in the world to eat fruit that are related to the monitors. And so you have a relative of the Komodo dragon living in the Philippines. Scientists did not pay any attention to the indigenous people's reports of it, and it's discovered. In 2008, Dr. Andrea Marshall discovered a brand new giant manta ray that's 26 feet across And she said the reason we never knew that giant monitor ray was here was it's cosmopolitan. It migrates all over the world. It's different than the giant manta ray that's much smaller, that never migrates, that lives in coastal areas. But she said we never listened to the natives about because it was hiding in plain sight. Huh. How did she discover it? She got a 3-year grant and went to dozens and dozens of fish markets all across Africa, comparing the two manta rays that were being sold in the fish markets and taking DNA sample until she could prove, and she got her PhD because she proved that a giant manta ray 26 feet across exists.
Wow, that's amazing. See, that kind of ties in too with the logo of the International Cryptozoology Museum, because unlike what people may think it would be, which is the Bigfoot, it's actually the coelacanth, because that's a creature that went from a cryptid to a confirmed animal, right?
Right, right. The native peoples called it a gambaza, and they ate it. They would occasionally catch these fish because they would come from the deep sea, but it's so large, it's over 5.5, 6.5 feet long, that they, of course, would keep the fish, eat it. It tasted terrible. It was oily, but it was big enough they would, you know, be able to feed several people for several days. 1938, whenever it was actually caught by a Western museum, it was East London museum director. She found it on a fish dock and wrote to one of the ichthyologist specialists in South Africa, found out that it had not been seen for 65 million years.
Oh, wow.
So when she discovered it in 38, that was a grand discovery. Then Dr. Smith, who she'd written to, became so obsessed he wanted to find a second one. He could not find a second one until 1952. It became such a media event in 1953. It actually stimulated and inspired the movie Creatures from the Black Lagoon.
Wow.
A lot of people don't know that the coelacanth is behind that movie.
These are the kind of information you get, folks, from Lauren Coleman, not just on the show, but when you go to the museum, he'll tell you these stories that even I've never heard of, amazing stuff. Now, you bring up the celebrity cryptid Loch Ness Monster. I feel like I have mixed feelings. I love the Loch Ness Monster, but I also feel like it's not dying in a literal sense, but it's like losing steam. But then I see pictures that come up every now and again, but it just doesn't seem like it's as hot as it was in the 80s. Back, you know, when I was a kid. What's the status, I guess you could say, of Nessie at this point?
Well, unfortunately, the feeling that you're talking about, a couple, 3 years ago, there was a lot of articles that came out. Robert Rhines said he thought that maybe the Loch Ness monsters were dead, that they had become extinct. I tried to tell all of my psychologically aware research friends that we had to be careful about what Robert Rhines was talking about. He was dying. The man himself, who had been behind so many expeditions, was growing old. He couldn't go to Loch Ness anymore. He was getting depressed about his contribution to the field, even though it has been great. And then he died. He died a couple Novembers ago. And so Robert Rhines, who had funded all of these expeditions that have produced some of the most famous underwater pictures from Loch Ness, the funding evaporated. His energy evaporated. Henry Bauer, another researcher, has grown old and doesn't go to Loch Ness anymore. So you're getting a kind of a changing of the guard. And when that happens in any kind of research, you oftentimes get a sense from some of the older people that are involved in it that, you know, that we can just kind of give up, that the things aren't there anymore. And we have to be careful about that. There's a whole group of young researchers coming up that are interested in the Loch Ness Monster, that are still there, still trying for the kind of underwater cams and the shore cams. We're getting films from there. Holmes came up with the film a couple years ago. And we have to be careful. It's just that Robert Rhines was a patent lawyer, had an enormous amount of money, funded year after year of submarines, of side sonar cameras, of lots of equipment. We haven't had anybody step up with that kind of funding since he passed away. So you're kind of hearing that not that much from Loch Ness. But there was an active summer of reports here and there from Loch Ness. Some of them were mistakes, such as some reflections from some houses on the shore that looked like they were white objects in the water. But there were some other ones that were looked like creatures in the water. The other thing that when I was over there in 1999 and I really came to grips with the reality of it for me is that there's about 40 reports of the Loch Ness Monster on land, variously described as a walrus, a giant slug, a camel. And most of the people, the individuals I interviewed who were eyewitnesses, they never talk about a neck. They never talk about a head. They talk about the Loch Ness Monster as an oversized, overturned boat, a giant whale, the back of a walrus. And whenever you think about it, Loch Ness is only 6 miles from the ocean down the River Ness. I think that what you have going on with Loch Ness is not that many good reports, and the infrequent reports that we do hear seem to be seasonal, they seem to be cyclic, and you may have either blooms of fish or breeding going on, or, you know, there are small family reports of Loch Ness monsters. It's not just one Nessie. But it is something that we have to consider. It's going to be pretty hard to find. The other thing that a lot of people don't know is that there's actually enough water in Loch Ness to bury everyone on Earth under 6 feet of water.
Oh, wow. Really?
It's that massive. It's that the volume of water in Loch Ness is really inconceivable to human beings.
I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around it right now.
Yeah.
And that's so it's just massively deep, I guess, then, right?
Oh, it's over 1,000 feet deep in most places.
Wow. Strange.
23 miles long, and quite broad in some places. And I'm going to do the Scottish some injustice, but it has a thing across the water that's called the Har. And the Har is this rolling fog that really makes it quite hard to see what's going on in the water most of the time.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, what about some of these other lake monsters like the Ogopogo and the Champ? I mean, what are your thoughts on those in general? And is it sort of possible that we're dealing with a situation similar to what we were talking about here with the Bigfoot, where there's just different animals that we're probably contending with here?
Well, I think that is somewhat true. I think that what goes on in Champ, with Champ and the Lake Champlain monsters, you have a lake that's almost as big as Loch Ness, but it's only 200 and 300 feet deep. It also is frozen more. And so you do have misidentifications of sturgeon. But the Eric Olson film that was taken 2 years ago is a remarkable piece of footage that shows something that looks like a giant otter. Myself and some other cryptozoologists went over there, and we were able to measure the exact spot that this creature was seen. And it looks to be, 12, 15 feet long. Certainly not a dog in the water, not a normal otter. So, you've got some possibilities for creatures that are warm-blooded. I've always thought it was a mistake to try to pigeonhole all of these lake monsters as plesiosaurs or marine reptiles, because over and over again, people say that they see a mane, they see whiskers, they see eyebrows. And the dead kicker for me is that if you actually look at the way that they say that these creatures are swimming, they're swimming up and down in the water, not side to side. The side to side swimming, because of the structure of the spine of a fish and a reptile, doesn't match the up and down that you get for these lake monsters, which exactly matches a mammal.
Yeah.
The seals, the otters, the whales, they all go up and down in the water. And so I think we're dealing with large, warm-blooded, long-necked seals of some kind that are really in the boreal forest lakes in what we call the monster latitudes in a band that goes right around the northern tier of North America, I mean, northern United States and southern Canada, right around Scotland, Ireland, and on over into Russia and Asia. Mm. You have the same kind of reports in this band right around the world.
Interesting, yeah, yeah. I never even connected that, the latitudinalness of it. Interesting, interesting.
Yeah, yeah, that's another Ivan Sanderson. He wrote in his one of his books and called these the monster latitudes, and it was a, as he would say, it was a spot-on theory.
Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the Montauk Monster, because that's one of those things that sort of, it was such a weird picture that it'll almost never go away, because it's so, you know, visually bizarre, but I have a feeling that it's probably just some anomalous, you know, effect of onto an animal that we already know about. But I'm sure you've seen the picture, you've seen all the conjecture. What's your take on the whole Montauk Monster thing?
Well, this is one of those things that my name will live on forever in Wikipedia, because I'm the one that coined the name Montauk Monster. And so I have in the museum the first American replica of the Montauk Monster. And myself and Darren Nash over in England, we came up with a positive identification based upon the skull structure and the feet and the actual size, because all we had to do was, I saw the picture with the fly on it, as opposed to it being something like 6 feet long, which people exaggerated. You had to scale down the picture to the size of the fly. Mm-hmm. It was a raccoon that had lost all of its hair in second stage decomposition.
Ew.
In second stage decomposition, you have a carcass like that being floating in and out of the shore, and the whole hair just sloughs right off.
Yeah.
And so that's why people say that it looked like a griffin, it looked like a devil, it looked like a sea turtle. Also, what was the other one? Oh, that it, you know, looked like a pig or a hog. It was just a bloated raccoon.
Interesting.
And the unfortunate thing is, because it went viral in 2008, the next summer there was another Montauk Monster 2. There was two Montauk Monsters in England. There was a creature that washed up in a creek in Panama that was a sloth. Last year, there was another one that washed up, except had fur on its head, up in Ottawa, in Ontario, and it turned out to be a mink. So you've now, the Montauk Monster, the success of the media being able to distract people from wars and taxes and their miserable situation by talking about a creature that's nothing more than a dead animal on a beach, you now have it replicated over and over and over again that this has become a media darling.
Yeah.
So.
Very interesting. See, I'm glad. I like to think of this program as sort of like the paranormal program of the record, or on the record. So it's good to have this for future.
And there are a lot of unknowns, and it is unfortunate. We're in a period where the most phone calls I get from, you know, print media and online media are, will I identify this chupacabra? Will I identify this dead body?
Right, right, right.
And they're all not hoaxes, they're just misidentifications, whereas I'd much rather be talking about the realistic reports of Bigfoot and Yeti and, you know, the Black Panther reports, or even, you know, the story of the mountain lion that got killed in Connecticut, and the government tried to explain it away as a creature from the Black Hills of South Dakota.
Really? Really? Why would they do that? Just because they don't want to admit that there may be alien big cats running around?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, about 4 months ago, the U.S. government came out with the final edict saying that there are absolutely no eastern panthers east of the Mississippi, except for one population in Florida. And then what happens on June 11th? There were many sightings of a mountain lion in Connecticut. It gets struck on the road in Connecticut and killed. And all of the newspapers, the media arrive, and it's a body of a cat. And then it takes about a week for them to do testing, And they quickly have a news conference and said, this is a cat that has DNA in it from South Dakota, and you know, it's not a pet. It's got wild animals in its stomach, so it's definitely a wild animal. So we think it walked for 3 years across the United States to Connecticut. Now, there's been hundreds of reports in that time from all over the East. Now, what's happened since then is, from my back channel sources, I found out that the actual findings are that there's the DNA sample shows that 66% of the DNA matches up with the mountain lions in South Dakota. And you've probably got a situation in all of the East where you'll be able to match up DNA with two-thirds of some other cat in some other part of the eastern United States. It's just turning out that they tried too hard to explain away this cat, and that we do think that there are eastern mountain lion in the United States in the East, and they all aren't explained as circus trains crashes, as escaped pets, as drug dealer pets, and other things that we keep hearing about. There's a wild population of mountain lions in the East.
And you touched on another one of my pet peeves actually earlier, and that's just this weird sort of like chupacabra frenzy that's gone on in the last few years, where it's just clearly like some kind of sick dog. And it's like, it's not a chupacabra, but it's like always these local news reports I see on YouTube that are like, chupacabra found in Tallahassee or something like that. And it's like, no, that's a dog that's sick or something, you know, but it's not what we've been told is the chupacabra, it seems.
No, the reports, there was a new one this summer of a hospital worker in Maryland taking pictures. He caught it in a trap in Maryland and then released it, said it was a chupacabra. They come out of Maryland, Texas, the Carolinas, Oklahoma. 100% of those four-legged chupacabra turn out to be canids, dogs, coyotes, foxes, coy dogs with mange.
Mm-hmm.
And mange causes all of the hair to come off of these animals, and they look weird. You know, an animal without hair, its nose looks very pointed. It looks like it has a rat tail. So people use the word chupacabra all the time incorrectly. The classic chupacabras in Puerto Rico and South America are always bipedal. They stand on two legs, and they're actually covered in short gray hair. They're not hairless. They're not four-legged. They don't, they don't look like these morphed Texan chupacabras. It's just a sad mistake that's been made. And actually, myself and some other researchers tracked down the first time that chupacabras was actually used on TV. It wasn't in 1995, like the Puerto Rican reports exploded in 1995. The first chupacabra on TV was mentioned in 1960 on Bonanza, and actually a Mexican farmhand is telling the Cartwrights about a chupacabras that actually sucks milk from goats, not blood.
Strange.
Yeah.
Strange. That makes you wonder just this, if this is just some weird, like, thing that's permutated over the years that, you know, it just sounds like a lot
well,
of
there's,
confusion.
There's a translation for the, there's a certain kind of bird, the whippoorwills, that sometimes are called chupacabras. And there is some folklore among Hispanic folks of them sucking milk from goats too. So we've got to dive a little bit deeper into this whole business, the connection between the whippoorwills, the chupacabras, the mangy dogs, and the upright creatures that almost seem like they're part alien. But I think a lot of that has to do with the first researchers in 1995 who were interviewing the eyewitnesses were not cryptozoologists. They were ufologists because there were no cryptozoologists available. So all of the first people that went in and interviewed all the chupacabra with eyewitnesses were putting it in context that it had to be some kind of alien.
Interesting. Yeah, that adds a whole other realm of a whole other dimension of misidentification confusion to the whole mystery of that. Now, we've talked about the land animals here. We've talked about the sea animals. I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't mention sort of the air creatures of cryptozoology, of course, being the big one, the Thunderbirds. I know your friends at Mark Hall, and you know Ken Gerhard very well. What are your thoughts sort of on where we stand on the Thunderbirds?
Well, it's kind of been pretty quiet. I mean, there have been reports from Southwest Pennsylvania of Thunderbirds. There's been some reports from Southeast Alaska. But in general, in the last 10 years or so, it's been pretty quiet. A lot of people, of course, love to talk about the 1948 and 1977 Illinois cases, and Mark Hall certainly did a lot of investigations of that, as I did and my brother Jerry. So, there hasn't been really anything new. There's not been any large feathers dropping from the sky and things like that. There has been some fossil evidence that keeps coming up of these pterotaurs, the giant condor-like birds, being found in association with human bones in like La Brea tar pits and things like that, which are kind of exciting in a sort of a backdoor kind of way. I wonder if we're going to learn more about the Thunderbirds by having some new fossil discoveries that will really kind of shake up science in general.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, the more evidence we can get for these things, the better. Now, is there any – you talked about sort of like the celebrity cryptids, and we've talked about, you know, the Thunderbirds and Ogopogo and Champ and some of the ones that are on the – I guess you could say this next tier. But is there any sort of like a crypto creature that, you know, you find particularly fascinating that you don't think gets its due, you know? Maybe I presume it's not the Mongolian death worm, but,
yeah.
I'm thinking along those lines, something –
Well, I just to mention the cats one more time, I'm really interested in how Black Panther reports 40% of the mystery cats around the world, mm-hmm. whether they're the ABCs, the alien big cats in the UK, or the Black Panthers of the Blue Mountains of Australia, or the Black Panthers of California, or the Black Panthers of Vermont or Massachusetts. They're seen so frequently, and you know they definitely are killing wildlife, killing livestock, leaving footprints. Yet they're not caught. There is no black panther that exists zoologically in North America, but there's not a weekend that goes by when somebody doesn't come through the museum who's been an eyewitness but never told anybody about it. And so they are more frequently seen than Bigfoot. But it's this tier of cryptids that everybody just takes for granted that, well, of course there's Black Panthers. Why should I even talk to anybody about it? And in a similar kind of opposite but interesting parallel universe, there's the Tasmanian tiger, which, of course, is not a tiger but a marsupial. And those are still being actively reported in Western Australia and in New Guinea. And I think of all of the animals that may be an exciting discovery over in that part of the world, we're certainly finding over and over again New Guinea gives us a new animal, new species surprises. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Tasmanian tiger isn't discovered in New Guinea and really throws everybody for a loop since they think it's going to be found in Australia. So there's, but the one that a kind of a hidden creature in Europe that I think needs to be more research needs to be done about it is the tazoverm. The tazoverm are these 4 foot long, almost like a giant beaded lizard that are often reported in the Alps. And I've told several of my artist friends that have said they wanted to donate something to the museum. I think one of the easiest models that I don't have is a 4 foot long tazoverm, and I'd certainly like one of those for the museum. So I think that may happen just by me wishing for it so often.
See, I've never even heard of that, so that's even stranger, yeah. Well, the cool thing, too, about cryptozoology, what you point out here with the alien big cats or the Black Panthers is that, you know, it's not just mystery animals that we can't quite identify or prove the existence of yet. It's also the idea of animals in the wrong place, or animals existing in a place where they're not supposed to, or not, people say they don't exist.
Right, right. Well, there's two main categories of cryptids. There's the cryptids that we will find are completely new animals, new species that surprise us all, you know, a new large monkey in Asia, or a bird that they discover here or there. Or, I mean, people say there's no new animals being found in North America, but it's been a quite exciting 12 months where a giant crayfish was discovered in Tennessee that's twice as big as the crayfish that everybody knew about, and a brand new turtle was discovered in Mississippi, never seen before. So new animals are even being found in North America. And then the whole other category of cryptids are animals that we feel are recently extinct and are being misidentified as some unknown kind of creature. And there we have the ivory-billed woodpecker, the Tasmanian tiger, and some of these creatures that are recently extinct that still may be around. And it could even be something like the teratorn, which died out in the Pleistocene, is really the thunderbirds, and they're still around, and we just haven't caught one yet.
Okay, interesting. That's a good sort of end point here for this conversation. And you know, talk a little bit about, once again, the big move for the International Cryptozoology Museum. People can find out more about that, of course, at cryptozoologymuseum.com. But, you know, what's going on October 30th and beyond?
Well, on October 30th, we're going to have a grand monster reopening at 11 Avon Street, Portland, Maine. That's our new address. On the day before Halloween, the museum is going to be open from noon to 6 o'clock with a special one-time admission of $2. Unfortunately, because our rent is going up, the $5 admission is going to go up to $7. So this is everybody's one-time chance to come on the 30th and get in for $2. And we will be giving away Halloween candy for free. and then we're going to be open regular hours. We're closed on Mondays and Tuesdays. Although we are considering, we're going to have a board meeting on the 30th. We're going to consider opening on Monday holidays because so many schools around here are closed.
Yeah.
That it seems natural that a lot of people might come out on Monday holidays to come to the museum.
Nice. Yeah, that would make sense too, because a lot of people, three-day weekends, they go out and travel a lot and stuff
exactly.
Like that. And beyond the big move for the museum, what's next for you? You said you've already written about 35 books. I'm sure you've got several more in you. So, you know, what's on tap? I have a feeling you've got some of the works.
I'm finishing up Monsters of Massachusetts. That's my next book that'll be out next year. Then I'm going to do Monsters of New York, looking to do a book about all of the strange museums across the United States, a general cryptozoology book, a book called Bigfoot in Maine. Actually, I think I have about 6 book contracts in the pipeline. So I've got more than enough to work to keep me busy for a few years. And then, of course, my biggest hope is of all of my books, I have one book that has a movie option on it, and that's the Tom Slick book. And if that comes through, and there is a good possibility there will be a Yeti movie made in the next 3 years, and if that comes through, then the funding for the museum is going to be quite secure, because I'll be donating a lot of the proceeds from that movie to the museum.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like the sky's the limit here. It's been such an amazing ride for the ICM, and you know, it's just so gratifying, really, because I know you've struggled for years in this field, and to see it, this acceptance and this embracing by the media is just so gratifying, you know, to see from afar, and I'm sure it's been amazing for you.
Oh, yeah. It's so good to know that people are really seeing it's a scientific, entertainment, educational, fun place to visit that people are coming to see it.
And any speaking engagements or TV appearances we should plug here, or is that sort of still in the pipeline?
I've already, I mean, I've got a talk locally in Portland next week, and November 2012 in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. So I've got a few things that I'll be posting online for people to find.
Nice.
Where I'll be talking.
Nice. And chances are you can see Lauren just about any time you turn on one of these cryptozoology programs, because he's all over the place on Monster Quest and a bunch of other shows. So.
Right. And even some of my hair is still brown in some of those. And, of course, we'll all be watching and hoping that the cryptids, the Cardinals, will win the World Series.
Well, on that note, I got to thank you once again, Lauren, for coming on the show. I know you're extremely busy, and it's very difficult to pin you down to do a program, but to have you sit down with us here for 90 minutes has been just amazing and really been great to sort of catch up and get a look at where we stand in the world of cryptozoology from the man, really, who is just the pillar of the field. So it's been fantastic for me, and you know, it's just humbling for me to be able to call you such a good friend. So
yeah.
It's been great.
Well, it's really great talking to you again, Tim, and I look forward to your next visit to the museum up here in Maine.
Absolutely. I'm going to try and come up as soon as I can.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Big, big thanks, of course, to Lauren Coleman for coming on the show and giving us so much time. Check out his website, www.cryptomundo.com, CRYPTOMUNDO.com. And if you are within reach, you definitely want to go and visit the International Cryptozoology Museum. It is a fantastic place. You can find out more about that at www.cryptozoologymuseum.com. If you haven't yet, definitely make the trip to the ICM. You will not be disappointed. Before we get into listener feedback, let's take a moment here and talk a little bit about the scheduling as we move forward in Season 6. You just heard Episode 626, and the plan here at BOA HQ is to wrap up Season 6 with Episode 630, so next week's edition will kick off the final four of Season 6. And even though the shows have been sporadic at best, I'm trying to get them to you faster. The weather now is kicking my ass, so it's been one thing after another for me. Nonetheless, my big goal is to wrap up Season 6 by the end of November, because right around the corner are the holidays, and then we got to get down to business with the annual BOA Audio Holiday Special, and we definitely want that to be a part of Season 7. And I'm just terrified of a BOA Audio season going over 1 year. I mean, that's almost certainly going to happen, but we definitely want to get the show wrapped up by the end of November. So keep an eye out for the final four of Season 6, starting next week with Cucullin O'Reilly talking about deadly equines. Now let's move on to BOA Audio listener feedback. We got 3 emails in the till, getting progressively smaller. We start out with the first one, which is the largest. It comes from Laura F., and she is an international listener. Here's what she has to say. Just wanted to write and let you know that you are indeed still gaining new listeners. I've been listening to C2C and Red Ice for years, but have branched out a little more lately. Some random Google search, don't even remember what it was, led me to your site. Your interviews are such a treat, and maybe more than you realize. I've been in South Korea for almost 2 years, and my internet connection is of extreme importance. It's how I interact with the English world these days. Going through your archives has brought me great joy and comfort the last few weeks, as well as lots of intrigue. I enjoyed 2 shows in particular. One was about the Fraser Lands in Kentucky. I'm a native. Hadn't heard that story before. I also listened to the guy in Season 4 who researched Columbine. Wow! Even if I can't quite wrap my head around his conclusions, I don't want to go there. I thought his research was excellent and incredibly interesting. I had no clue other than the mainstream media info about the case. If he makes any headway into the Virginia Tech thing, I hope he can be on your show again. Anyway, I sent you a Facebook request, but get that you might not use it for fans. I was really glad to hear you read letters at the end of your show, so I found your email address instead. Just wanted to tell you thanks so much for all your work, and extra thanks for making your archives available. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Laura in South Korea. Wow. Thank you for writing in, Laura. Lots to respond to here. First of all, the random Google searches, that's the result of the massive BOA recaps on these episodes. People often wonder why we have such lengthy text recaps on each episode. That's because that's how new folks find the program, via random Google searches, which turn up BOA audio. Next, I just want to take a moment and, you know, express some awe that you are listening all the way in South Korea. Just another country we can put the pushpin in for BOA audio. Just amazing that someone out there in South Korea right now is listening to me speak and listening to me read their emails. So this really is a global grassroots program, my friends. Thank you, Laura, for reaching out and letting us know that you are representing BOA over there in South Korea. With response to the two shows that you mentioned that you liked so much, the Fraserlands in Kentucky, very happy to hear you write to me about that one. That's one of those episodes that kind of slipped under the radar for a lot of people. I didn't hear too much feedback on that show. So to hear it called back 2 years later is really gratifying. So thank you for mentioning that episode, Laura. And I couldn't help but chuckle here with regards to our old buddy William Zabel. Once again, really captivating the BOA audio listeners, even the newcomers who stumble upon that Columbine episode. Couldn't help but laugh when I saw that Laura picked out the William Zabel episode. Laura, I don't know if you've heard or not, but William Zabel is missing in action. We've been trying to get a hold of him pretty much since that episode aired, and he has vanished. So the William Zabel mystery continues here on BOA audio. And finally, the Facebook request. I'd be happy to approve your request, Laura. I'm just really lazy and I procrastinate, and I let those Facebook requests pile up and then one day just sort of approve like 50 people at once. So sit tight. Once I finish posting this installment of BOA Audio, I will definitely go in and approve your Facebook friend request and be happy to have you as part of our circle of friends. Let me turn it around on you. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your support of the program and for your really enthusiastic email. It is much appreciated. Next email comes from Melissa, no hometown listed. Here's what she has to say. I am a wee bit late to the Lost party, and it looks like I can't download the Lost cast anymore. Everyone is done with Lost and doesn't want to talk about it, and I remember that you had a series of discussions, but when I clicked the MP3, it goes to a web hosting site. Does that mean it is gone forever? Thanks for all you do, and if I missed it, well, too bad for me, I guess. Melissa, new Lost fanatic. I hate to be the bearer of bad news here, Melissa, but the Lost cast has gone offline, and it is really so far down on the BOA priority list to get it back online that it is highly unlikely that it will really see the light of day. I don't know, until maybe when there's some kind of Lost reunion or a Lost movie, then we'll revive the Lost cast and put the archive back up. But when we had the great audio switch of the spring of 2011 here at BOA Audio, the Lost cast fell offline. And as I said, we just haven't had a chance to take the time to put it back online. I don't know, maybe one of the Lost cast listeners can reach out and send these MP3s to Melissa, because I feel bad, but we'll come up with something, Melissa. I'll get back in touch with you. We'll figure out a way for you to get the Lost cast, but as I said, it's very unlikely that I'll have the chance to put it back online. Next email comes from Ray, no hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. Moon Hoax, excellent show. I must have listened to that one 20 times. Keep up the good work, Ray. That's it. That's all he has to say. Just wanted to read that one in a way, I guess, because, you know, sometimes we put out some pretty wacky episodes. Sometimes we put out shows that are really, I guess you'd say, covering topics that are shunned by the world of paranormal media or the general realm of esoterica and maybe looked at as a little woo-woo. But I'm more than happy to look at some of the more stranger theories and research that's out there in the world of the paranormal, because I find those concepts really interesting and really the people behind those concepts to be equally interesting. So to hear Ray say that he enjoyed the Moon Hoax episode so much that he listened to it 20 times is pretty cool, and I'm glad you enjoyed it that much, Ray. And that closes the book on listener feedback. Thanks to Laura, Melissa, and Ray for writing in. Let me give you the means to contact me if you want to be a part of future installments of BOA Audio Listener Feedback. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com, or you can go to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the contact button. And the final method, of course, is to join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. It is BOA's paranormal playground, the United States of Esoterica. Lots of cool discussion going on there with regards to BOA audio, the paranormal, and the world of pop culture as well. And I would be remiss if I did not mention that I am a part of Facebook and Twitter. So if you are also on those sites, feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. Now let's take a moment and thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff for their help and support at the website and the program. They are, of course, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our contributing cartoonist Andy Carolan, and our webmaster Jeremy Boston. I got bunches of stuff from the BOA staff that is waiting to get posted. Just put up a new column from Regan Lee at the website yesterday, so head on over and check that out and make it a part of your daily search for esoteric news and opinion. We're working on a whole bunch of cool stuff here as the holiday season begins. Now comes the part of the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to the BOA Audio listeners and ask you to help us out by making a donation to the website and the audio series. How do you do that? There's two ways to do so. You can go to BOA and make a donation via PayPal. There's a button on the left-hand side of the screen. But what if you don't trust the internet and you want to donate via snail mail? We have a way that you can do that as well. Send your donations to Tim Benall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. Let me spell Pinehurst for you. That's P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T. So the complete snail mail address is Tim Benall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And we have two caveats if you send us a donation. First, please make it out to Tim Benall and not Benall of America, because my bank will not cash that donation. And please include your email address so I can shoot you a line and say thanks for your donation. And as always, the standard disclaimer applies. All donations go towards Benall of America and BOA Audio to help keep the website and the audio series up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. Next week on the program, I teased it at the end of the last episode, so I'm not sure if I can even do it justice this time around, but of course our guest is going to be Cucullin O'Reilly, author of the book Deadly Equines, The True Story of Meat-Eating and Murderous Horses. Certainly a crypto topic if there ever was one. Cucullin has uncovered some amazing information about meat-eating horses. I mean, there's no real way to couch the term. Horses that eat meat and the habitual meat-eating of horses spanning thousands of years. I've talked to a lot of people since I did this interview, sort of floated the idea of horses eating meat, and so many people are flabbergasted when I tell them about this concept. But the more you hear about it and the more you learn from Cucullin O'Reilly, the more believable and realistic it becomes. This is a two-hour-plus conversation that covers the meat-eating horses, the murderous horses, and a whole bunch of other really interesting sociological horse-related topics. So definitely one folks are going to want to check out. I personally think it is a classic edition of BOA Audio and the perfect episode to kick off the final four of Season 6. Cucullin O'Reilly talking about deadly equines next week on BOA Audio. And on that note, we close the book on another edition of BOA Audio. Big, big thanks once again to Lauren Coleman for coming on the show. Check out his websites and definitely check out the International Cryptozoology Museum in Portland, Maine. Thanks to Laura, Melissa, and Ray for running in on this week's installment of BOA Audio Listener Feedback. And, of course, big, big thanks to all you folks out there, the amazing BOA Audio listeners. You guys just continue to humble me with your support of this program. You folks are just awesome. So thank you for your support of the program, and thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.